And it's to the Bible, to God's Word, that we turn together. This morning we're going to be reading 2 Kings chapter 5. It's page 373 in the Pew Bibles. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told her what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means, go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter, I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message: "Why have you torn your robes? Make the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go, wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call in the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and went off in a rage. Naaman's servant went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, 'Wash and be cleansed'?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant." The prophet answered, "As surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing." And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. "If you will not," said Naaman, "please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, and I bow there also, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this." "Go in peace," Elisha said. After Naaman had traveled some distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, "My master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him." So Gehazi hurried after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running towards him, he got down from his chariot to meet him. "Is everything all right?" he asked. "Everything is all right," Gehazi answered. "My master sent me to say, 2 young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them 1 talent of silver and 2 sets of clothing." "By all means, take 2 talents, said Naaman. He urged Gehazi to accept them, and then tied up the 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 sets of clothing. He gave them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them ahead of Gehazi. When Gehazi came to the hill, he took the things from the servants and put them away in the house. He sent the men away and they left. Then he went in and he stood before his master Elisha. "Where have you been, Gehazi?" Elisha asked. "Your servant didn't go anywhere," Gehazi answered. But Elisha said to him, "Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to take money or to accept clothes, olive groves, vineyards, flocks, herds, or men servants and maid servants? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever." Then Gehazi went from Elisha's presence, and he was leprous, as white as snow. We thank God for this reading from his word.
Well, if you have a Bible with you or close to you, let's turn together to 2 Kings 5 as we consider this story of Naaman. The biggest story calls this Grime and Punishment, which is a pretty creative title. Some of you know I was away for some time. I was at a conference in Berlin run by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. I'm going to say a wee word about that tonight, all being well. But when I was traveling to the conference, we stopped at Erfurt, a town in central southern Germany, and one of the places that Martin Luther frequented. It was in Erfurt Cathedral that Luther was ordained. We had a little bit of time. We went and visited that cathedral. We stood at the very place in front of the altar where he prostrated himself, where he lay in a sort of a cross shape before the altar as he was ordained and took vows to become a monk. And it was Erfurt that he came back to quite often to preach as the Reformation progressed. And Erfurt was one of those places that really embraced the Reformation quite strongly. Now, at that time, as we know, the church of the day had, by and large, lost its way, not on everything, but on many important doctrines, and especially with how a person is made right with God. That was the really, really key issue. And the common understanding that had sort of permeated the church at the time was that salvation included your works, what you did. In other words, God's blessing was secured by what you did. And even at times, and we know about the indulgences that Tetzel was selling and so on that would get you out of purgatory, all those sorts of things that had no basis in the Bible, it was salvation was secured by what you paid. And it was Luther's understanding that salvation was by faith alone, by grace alone, that played such a key role in the Reformation, and that has led in no small part to ourselves being here today. Now, one of the things that Luther came to understand was that approaching God, relying on what we have done, in other words, approaching God sort of based on our works, is very natural to us. It's where the human heart casts anchor, naturally casts anchor, he said. In other words, if a person follows their natural hunches about how to come to God, that's very likely where they're going to end up. They're going to say, well, you know, if there is a God and I've got to come to him, I must not come empty-handed. The natural implication of the human heart will be that I'll say something like, God will help those who help themselves. I'll do my bit and maybe God will do his bit. I'll scratch his back, he'll scratch mine, sort of thing. And Luther would have said that was really where the human heart would naturally tend to if we're left to ourselves. We sort of think in terms of works. We're wired to think that way. And of course, not only did Luther come to understand that that's what we are like, but God understands that that's what we are like. And so time and time again in the Bible repeatedly underlines that salvation is not something that can be earned. It's not something that can be bought or influenced by what we do, but it must be received as a free gift. And because that's a hard lesson for us to learn, and a difficult position for us to maintain, actually, too, it seems that God wants to underline for us again and again. And so this point is made often in the scriptures. And in this story before us today, that is what we see. God's grace is taught and illustrated and underlined for us in this beautiful story of Naaman. So that's what we're going to think about. All of this happened about the 9th century BC. And at this time, the people of God are being oppressed by the Syrians, or the Arameans, as the NIV puts it. The king of Israel and the kings of Israel at this time are by and large a pretty unspiritual bunch and an unimpressive bunch. But there is a man of God in the land, and he is Elisha. Now, last week, we saw Elijah at the center of the story, and now we are dealing with Elijah's successor, Elisha. But the story doesn't start with Elisha. It starts with a man called Naaman. And he is not an Israelite, but he is a Syrian. And he's not just any Syrian, but he is the commander of their army. He is Field Marshal Naaman. And he's a great man. He has power. He has prestige in the land of Syria. He is well thought of by the king of Syria. He looks like he's sort of second in command. And it seems that he really has everything going for him. Well, almost everything. Because he has leprosy. And that's the way the Bible sort of describes it. It sort of builds up how great he was and then says, but he had leprosy. It's a bit of a bombshell. He was a leper. But he has something going for him that he doesn't perhaps realize at the beginning, and that is that there is an Israelite servant girl working in his household. She has been kidnapped by one of the raids that the Syrians undertook against the Israelites, captured as a little girl, and put to work in this powerful household. And I imagine that the life of such a servant girl was none too pleasant, and she had every reason to be bitter against those who had torn her away from her family and so on, and every reason to wish misfortune on her captors. But rather than hate her enemies, she loves her enemies, and she wishes her master well. And so she says to her mistress, Naaman's wife, in verse 3, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." There is a cure, she says, and the prophet has it. Now, this is her enemy, and yet she is pointing him to the prophet, Elisha. It's a lovely detail in the story. She's a lovely detail in the story. She's so different from Naaman, isn't she? She is so unimportant in so many ways, so much so that she's not even named. But she is faithful in these dreadful circumstances, and it is her that God uses. God uses the weak things of this world to shame the wise so often, and he does that here. And salvation comes to Naaman through this unnamed faithful witness. You know, we all have ambitions, don't we? What a wonderful ambition to be in the kingdom, an unnamed faithful witness. One that few know about, but God uses. Well, Naaman is desperate for help, and he goes to the king, his king, and his king sends him on his way with a letter for the king of Israel. There is some sort of pause and hostilities, it would seem, at this point, and Naaman is able to go and visit Elisha. So he travels south with much wealth, with this letter from the king, and he comes to the king of Israel. It's interesting that he looks for a prophet, and yet he goes to the palace, which is where he thinks that that's where such a powerful prophet would be, but it's not where he is. And the king of Israel thinks that this is some trick designed to start a diplomatic incident, and he tears his robe. He doesn't come out of this story particularly well. He knows that he can't cure leprosy. He's right about that. He knows that such a gift lies with God. He's right about that. And yet he doesn't think about sending Naaman to Elisha. Here's a king who, it seems, is unaccustomed to seeking out the voice of God. And it would seem, indeed, that that's maybe why the Syrians are such a thorn in their flesh at the moment. You see, back in verse 1, it says, "It is the Lord who has given Naaman victory." And some of those victories are undoubtedly against the Israelite people. His own people neglect him. We know that that's one of the patterns in the scriptures. His own people neglect him, and he uses sometimes the pagan nations to irritate his own people that they might be brought to his their senses. Well, somehow Elisha hears about all of this, and he sends for Naaman, and you notice what his concern is. You see what he wants him to know in verse 8? Let him come now to me, that he may know there is a prophet in Israel. So he wants this man not just to be cured of his leprosy, but to know that God is speaking in Israel. He wants him to know that there is a true and living God, and that it is Israel's God, and that this God speaks. So Naaman is like so many people in the world today, maybe like some of us, we are spiritual, but we haven't sort of nailed our colors to any particular mast. We sort of think that there's spirituality here and there, and there's truth in there, and we maybe sort of design a sort of an a la carte spirituality. We take a little bit from this and a little bit from this and a little bit from this. And that, it looks, is where Naaman is as he comes down to Elisha. He's coming, probably worshiping the god Rimmon that we'll talk about in a moment or two. But he thinks, well, maybe there's some truth over there, and I'll incorporate that into my life. And Elisha wants Naaman to know that that's not the way to go, and that there is a truth, to know that all other gods are false gods, and that Israel's God is the living and true God. And soon, verse 9, Naaman is standing outside Elisha's door. Well, that brings us to our first point, simply 2 points this morning: the challenge of the gospel and the change that the gospel brings. So the challenge the gospel brings and the change the gospel brings is what we're looking at. The challenge the gospel brings. So the hotel that we were staying in Berlin, in fact, the hotel that the conference was in, it was a different hotel, was not far from the Brandenburg Gate, if any of you have ever been in Berlin. And just on the other side of the Brandenburg Gate is the Adlon Hotel. And it's where lots of important meetings took place. Some of you will know it is where hung the baby out over the balcony. Do you remember that? Michael Jackson, that's right, he did that. Not to be recommended at all. And caused a huge international sort of incident. But anyway, that was from the Adlon Hotel. And all these important meetings take place in the Adlon Hotel. And once, whenever we happened to walk past the Adlon Hotel, there was a huge line of police motorcycles sitting outside the hotel and a big sort of armored car. And we thought, oh, somebody really important is here. And so we're standing there with our phones, you know, we need to take a picture. And expecting maybe the German Chancellor or Donald Trump or something like that. And some lady emerged. I took her picture, got the back of her head. No idea who she was. Still don't really know. I think she was an ambassador of some country. But she seemed important, and off she went. Now, that's the sort of reaction that you would expect if Naaman pulled up outside your house. People taking pictures, the press there, the traffic stopped, everybody fussing over him. But you see what happens, verse 10? Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." So Elisha doesn't even go out to him. There's no fuss. There's no fawning over Naaman. He is he has to deal not with the prophet, but the prophet's message. Now, why is this? Is Elisha just being rude? No, well, not at all. Here we're being taught something very important. And that is, at the end of the day, what do we have to deal with in order that we might respond to the gospel? What do we have to deal with in order that we might become Christians? We must deal with the Word of God. Not even with the character of the prophet. It's not about what the prophet is like or what the prophet does. It's actually about the message. And the question is, will we hear the message and be obedient to the message of the gospel? That's what all of this hangs on, and it's what hangs on for Naaman. Well, you notice that this totally throws Naaman. Verse 11, Naaman was angry and went away saying, "Behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. So he wants something amazing to happen, you see. He wants something mysterious. He's spiritual, after all. He wants Elisha himself. He wants to deal with the top man. And he wants him to wave his hands and do all of these things. And he knows that as far as rivers go, Jordan is not that spectacular. There are better rivers back home. And so he's angry. And initially he thinks, my journey has been wasted. There is no truth here. Now, this is so often what happens with the gospel today, isn't it? People want to judge it by the messenger. Our culture looks for gurus and influencers. And if they are impressive, then we think, well, maybe I listen to what they say. Their lives seem to be successful. I'll do what they say. But no, you see, the gospel has a weight and an authority apart from the person who delivers it. So important. It is the message itself that we must reckon with. Lots of folk reject the message because they are not impressed with the messenger. It doesn't really make any sense, does it? Because ultimately it is the message that is true or false. It either works or it doesn't. The messenger doesn't matter all that much. And Elisha is just underlining that here. So you see also that this is humbling for Naaman. Naaman's a great man. He is used to people bowing before him, and he's used to being asked to do great things, you know, secure that city or defeat that army. And he says, yes, that's something I can do. But now what does he have to do? He has to bathe in a river seven times. It seems so simple. It's so humble. And again, this is what we see, isn't it? The gospel is a humbling message. It tells us we cannot do anything in order to be saved. It tells us that there is nothing that we contribute. All that we do is believe. We must come empty-handed, whether we are a Naaman or a beggar. In fact, if we are a Naaman, we must come as a beggar with nothing. And that of course, is why Elisha will not take any payment. That's really what happens in the second part of the story. Naaman offers to give a great gift to Elisha, and he refuses because Naaman must know that the offer of the gospel is free. And we must know that too. Now, we're not going to look much at what happens with Gehazi, Elisha's servant, but you heard the reading and how he went after Naaman and lied in order that he might get a gift for himself. And he is judged with great severity. Why? Well, not only because he had lied, but because he had muddied the principle that God's salvation is free and that you cannot contribute to it. I spoke recently to an older man about his journey to becoming a Christian. It was just a few weeks ago, and he now is in glory. He'd come to faith later in life, and as I said, he passed away since. But he said, you know, for years I knew that I was a sinner, but I struggled to believe in Jesus. I struggled to trust in Jesus. And I sort of teased that out from him. And I said, well, what was it? And he said, well, I really wanted to sort it out myself. That's an issue for lots of people. I want to be able to contribute. I want to say, well, now, Lord, I've done this. Does that get me in? This is my effort. Is that enough? We want to achieve salvation. Now, you remember the prodigal son? He comes to his senses and he heads home to see his father. And as he goes, he's sort of rehearsing the speech that he's going to make to his father whenever he sees him. You would do that if you'd done what he had done. You'd really want to get that right. And so he's got this speech going on in his head, and he says, I want you to make me like one of the hired men. That's his plan. And what's he wanting to do? He's wanting to work his way back into the Father's acceptance. He's really saying, now, Father, I have screwed up here hugely, but I want to atone for what I've done. But he doesn't get to say those things because the Father runs out to him, and before he can finish his speech, he finds that he is overwhelmed with the Father's love and acceptance, and the fatted calf is killed, and the ring is put on his finger, the shoes on his feet. Because, you see, the Father's love and acceptance is given to him as a gift and not as a payment for what he has done. It's so humbling. It's so simple. And maybe you find yourself here today and this is part of your issue. You just think there must be more to it. It just seems so simple. Just believe in Jesus. But aren't you finding, if you're stumbling over that, aren't you finding that in some ways that's not simple at all, because it means doing one of the hardest things, and that's humbling your pride and saying, I cannot do this for myself. He must do it for me. That's a huge place to get to. Well, Naaman storms off, but his servants have the good sense to appeal to him. Verse 13, but his servants come near and say to him, my father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, wash and be clean? You see, they're saying, this is a good deal. It is a great word. And the gospel is, of course, a great word. It offers cleansing before God. What a wonderful thing to be clean before the God of the universe, before whom we must stand. Spotless record, wash and be clean. So Naaman, to his credit, listens to them as he listened to the servant girl, and he goes to the Jordan. And seven times he goes into the river. I don't know why it's seven times. Maybe some of you have heard some explanation for this. I did not find one. Is it perhaps because there is a need for a certain persistence at times in order that we might come to Christ? It's not a whim becoming a Christian, is it? It's not something we might fall into. We must do it. We must lay hold of it. Naaman could fall into the Jordan once, but he had to go down into it seven times. And the seventh time, he emerges clean, free from his leprosy. And not just looking like a haggard general, but as one who has the skin of a baby. You can imagine what the soldiers called him from there on, baby-faced Naaman. You see, when God makes us new, he really makes us new. So you see, there's the challenge of the gospel. Nothing to contribute, humble yourself, and believe in the message of the Lord, beautifully portrayed in the story of Naaman. But while there are not things that Naaman can contribute, there are changes that result. And that brings us to our second point, and that is change. The change that the gospel brings. And this is just a word or two. This change is really important, and we see it here in Naaman. We sometimes say, Jesus takes us as we are. That's true. But the picture of salvation is that he doesn't leave us as we are. That's really important. And that's what we see here. The changes in Naaman are very significant. Let's look at them, a number of them. First of all, he becomes a man of conviction. Remember we said that he was journeying down to meet Elisha, and he was spiritual. He was drawing from all of these various sources. There's truth here, and there's truth here, and there's truth here. Look at verse 15. He returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him, and he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth, but in Israel. And he's not going to worship any other god. He's become this man of conviction. He had talked about the greatness of the Syrian rivers as if to say, don't think that there's anything special here in Israel. But now he knows that Israel's God is the God. Not just that he is greater, but that he is absolutely unique. And genuinely coming to the Lord does this. It doesn't lead us to a place that says, I've just found something that works for me. But it says, we say, I've found the one. And I know that there is no one else like him. The world wants us to say, your God works for you. He is one among many options. But genuine believers know that he is what? The way, the truth, and the life. He's become this man of conviction. He's become a man of humility, hasn't he? Our world does not think that conviction and humility can go together. It thinks that the way to humility is to say, like Naaman used to sort of say, well, I don't really hold on to anything. It's to have no convictions. But this work of grace in Naaman's life produces genuine humility. He talks about himself as your servant four times as he's before Elisha. Before that, he is irked that Elisha won't come out to him, and now he's saying, Elisha, I'm your servant. He has humbled himself to receive the gospel, and now the gospel has humbled him. And you see, the gospel changes the thing that the world cannot change. It makes us small. That's the very heart of the human problem, isn't it? That we want to be big. But the gospel makes us small. It helps us to see ourselves as little before an amazing God. And therefore, we're able to see others around us as those whom we may serve. Humility. And then obedience. There comes this strange request about two donkey loads of earth to be taken back to Syria, and all this about going into the temple of Rimmon. And we're not really sure what's going on with the earth. It seems to be some way of connecting himself to the God of Israel. It's him sort of earthing, if you pardon the pun, the truth that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. And then he's saying, if I have to go there, I'll go there, but my heart is really here. Maybe he's going to build an altar on it. Maybe that's where he's going to say his prayers. We don't really know. We can ask him in heaven. Naaman, you're looking really, really well. What was this about the donkeys and the earth? What did you do with that? But he also asks about part of his job. His job is to accompany his master, the Syrian king, into the temple of Rimmon, this false god. Now, he knows Rimmon to be a false god, but he's asking, is it okay if I do this? So you see, from someone who probably didn't care too much about really how he lived or what he did in terms of these things, he now has this sensitive conscience. He knows this God who has saved me, he wants me to live in a certain way. What is that way? How I live really matters. How I worship really matters. He doesn't want to offend this Lord. And so he wants to be obedient with him. And so he checks it out with Elisha. And Elisha gives him his blessing. Go in peace. So you see how the gospel has changed him? He's become this man of conviction, this man of humility, this man of obedience. And this is what the gospel is to do in us. So Jesus takes us as we are, but he doesn't leave us as we are. And we're not to grow just a little in these things and stop, but we're to carry on until the Lord calls us home. Are we growing in conviction and humility and obedience? We ought to be. So the challenge the gospel brings and the change the gospel brings. What a joy there is in realizing the gospel is free. What a joy there is in being reminded that God has welcomed us based on what he has done for us in Christ and not in what we do. And as we come back and see that afresh, we are changed afresh. Our convictions grow in a world that says you ought not to have any convictions. Our humility grows in a world that says you should put yourself forward. And our obedience grows in a world that says how you live doesn't matter. The challenge the gospel brings and the change the gospel brings. Let's pray together.